Access number 27804, Squadron Leader Ian Blair, Reel 31. Now, you're telling me about how there were the British rules for explosives, and different types of explosives had different sort of amounts they could have and the way they treat. And there was problems. If you want to continue the points you were making, you want to...
Yeah, well, the different classification, as we call it, of these explosives required attention to the storage. Now, in the case of high explosive shells, they were storing these in the former 21 MU storage area, which was underground storage, which I mentioned some time ago. These were tunnels on the cliffs, and apart from the narrowness of these tunnels and the narrow gauge railway and all the other ramifications, we did manage to store these things in pallets. Now, they were palletized, 105, 150 millimeter shells and great pallets, quite a substantial load, but they were safe, in inverted commas. That was what we were storing at Fole in the main. The other unit at Utoxeter, which the name was Bramshaw comes to mind, that was what it was called, Bramshaw, just outside Utoxeter, was... had no roads. It was all the sheds were served by a broad gauge railway, and because of its proximity to the town, it couldn't store high explosive. It stored cordite, literally, which is a propellant charge for the shells that we had down the road. But the problem was with the cordite was it was a great fire risk, as opposed to the shells, which were a shrapnel thing. And we were limited, but these sheds were literally stacked to the gunnels. The trains would drive in, and the trucks were level with the floors were built up so that they were level with the truck floors. So they just barrowed these things off and stacked them in great heaps. But they were really, that was quite fair enough, but that was the big problem there. It was simple enough. It was just the handling of the items that had to be manhandled off the railway trucks into the sheds on wheelbarrows. The limited forklift availability because the floors were 6 or 8 feet above the ground level, so you couldn't get your forklifts up there in the first place. You had to drive your forklifts in on a flatbed train and then drive them off. But in the case of Fold, that was HE. Now, the case of Fold, the railway siding that served Fold was the main line, which was 2 miles from the depot, and the ammunition came in on the railway lines and were transshipped from the railway, broad gauge railway, onto a narrow gauge railway, and then this narrow gauge railway trundled all the way up from the railway siding right up into the caves, literally. A 2-mile trip. And it was very intensive work because there were ships and trains were coming in thick and furious from the continent. Some came by road, which causes a bit of aggro, but they were coming. It was just a rapid move. And this American engineer company had just come from the States, stateside as the Americans call it, and they were greener than the proverbial cabbage. They'd never experienced overseas, inverted commas, albeit in UK, and they didn't know our ways of working, and they were driving around in these great big 2.5-ton trucks, six-wheeled trucks, churning up all the verges and the footpaths and the football pitches and all this sort of stuff. They were really working it. Well, they worked for the first month. They worked 24 hours a day, and they never got off the base, which I'll come to in a minute. So it was very intensive. I had to be there, hovering around in the background, telling them not to do this, don't do that. Now you must remember that. Or perhaps you don't remember, but Fold was the depot that blew up during the war in 1943. And if you refer to the Ordnance Survey map, you'll see the great big crater still there. And there was something in the region of 4,000 tons of explosive blew up. The cause was never really officially established, but it was said to be malpractice by the people handling the stuff. So here you have this underground storage unit, which used to be 22 miles of tunnels, reduced to something in the region of 7 or 8 miles because of the hill blew up. And in there was a brick wall built sealing the tunnels off from the devastated area. But you can still look through, still look in and see. I'm talking now about 28 years after the event, something like that. You could still look in and see the blackened soup, damaged roofs, the light fittings dangling, a typical bomb damage site. But this was off limits. And occasionally, even after all, a piece of the rock used to drop, which left a nice clean area, so you know, free from soot. And I said to the Americans when they first arrived, look, you've got to stick with our regulations because they're based as a result of accidents. They're not just conjured up of don't do this and don't do that. These are there for a specific purpose, and you are required to provide me with a certificate each month that you are in fact complying with this, the regulations. Oh yes, we'll do that. I know, I was a squadron leader, and it was a captain that was in charge, an American captain who was in charge of this outfit. And I used to go walk around with them or go with them, and I'd go into some of these areas, and I find they've been merrily smoking away. Because the fag ends were on the floor, and I said to this guy, I said, look, this is not on. I said, you're not supposed to be smoking in here. Oh, yes, we appreciate that. Well, we'll take care of that. So I said, well, you've got a defined smoking area, and you've got a gatehouse which controls it. I said, they're supposed to hand in all their smoking materials and you know, and take them into the shed in a box. That's the way we did it. That's the way you should do it. Oh, well, fair enough. So we never did stomp it out, but we reduced it considerably. Another thing the Americans used to do for some reason, they used to unscrew the plugs on the shells. So that's the lifting plugs. And that's absolutely forbidden in the Air Force. No, thou shalt not do it. Oh, I had a great trouble with that. They're supposed to be not allowed to do that. Oh, we do that stateside. I said, you know, sorry, you can't do it in this country. You mustn't do it. We're too heavily populated. You've got plenty of space over there. So anyway, that was one or two of the items. And we had a similar situation down the road at Bramshaw, which was a different type of area, but that was more a fire hazard. And the Americans sort of objected to having a firefighting party. We had to. They reckoned it was a waste of money, but never mind. We managed to persuade them that they had to have a firefighting party. We also had great difficulty in persuading them to get a mines rescue team going. But over the period of time, we did. And the classic example was I put some floodlights, you know, special flameproof floodlights, in this hole in the wall and shone into this cavern, smoke-blackened cavern with dangling lights. And I used to take the new guys around. I said, look, this is what happens when it goes off bang if you don't play it according to the rules. This did happen. We don't want it to happen again. Oh, yeah. So it was a good, for all the VIPs that visited, it was good for morale. But we had one major funny. I used to go up to Burton Wood regularly. I had a mini, as I used to go, just to chat the colonel up there. He used to say how I was doing, etc. And there was a liaison officer up there, but he was looking after just liaison for general stores, I suppose, to myself with explosives and one of the other guys. But we had a confrontation the very first day we arrived at Fold, where the Americans arrived, or I arrived. They wanted to put their ensign up, the Stars and Stripes, you see. And the Stars and Stripes they had was about 12 foot long. And the RAF ensign was only this standard 3 foot job. And I said, you can't put that up. They've got to be same size. The protocol demands that they are the same size. I said, no, I'm sorry. Until I get my, either you get a smaller one or I get a bigger one. So anyway, cut along. We were three weeks and a couple of visits from the colonel. So, and I want to know why they weren't flying the Stars and Stripes, and he agreed with me. He didn't know there was no animosity. He agreed. He didn't sort of lay down the rule, but that was one confrontation we had, and the other confrontation was after one month of hard graft. The sergeant major, or the equivalent of their sergeant major, the dissident, who was about 6 foot two, he was a parachutist from the 101 Airborne. He was as straight as a ramrod and a very slender guy, and he paraded all his GIs. I remember this when they were going to have a furlough, a pass as they call them, furlough. He paraded all these 15 or 20. GIs outside in the corridor in the office, and he went down the lines and now sent them all away, kept properly dressed. I never forget this, really. Anyway, he eventually released them and they went berserk because they had their own transport. But lo and betide, if anybody stepped out of line when he was on the. Everything went smooth until one morning the MOD police. Rang me from the guard room, was still over by MOD. Look, we've got four members of the what's it called, sir? CID here. CID. CID. He said the British CID. They want to see the commanding officer. I said, oh, well. Send them across. Oh, it's a standard headquarters, you know, just by the guard room. It's a permanent. So up come. So I said, I'll send them. So I took my office was next door to this captain. So I said, I'll send them up. So I said, these guys said, well, we got a matter to deal with the barracks. So I said, well, come on in. So I took them in. So I introduced them all around, and they said, we've had reports filter through. That the GIs are flogging whiskey in the local vicinity at about 15 shillings a bottle. And we come to investigate this. Witnesses say that the guys are going from Scropton. Now, Scropton was the railway siding, which is about two miles away. So anyway, to cut a long story short, the captain said, right, I'll investigate. He said, no. And he said, we will investigate. We want to get to the bottom of this. So the wheels went into motion. And before midday, they had about 15 guys up in front of the, going through the thing, the rigmarole. And eventually then the police narrowed it down to three guys and... What had happened was, these three guys were eventually charged with this felony, and the Americans wanted to deal with them, and the police said, no, we'll deal with them. And then so there was a bit of hassle and bringing up of various hype. But in the end, what happened was that into the siding had come a sealed truck, like all the other sealed trucks, carrying explosives, so we thought. And it was a big siding, railway siding, mainline siding, which held 100 trucks, which is quite... And when they opened this truck door, which is sealed, they found it was full of whiskey in bond going from Edinburgh to South Wales, and for some reason it got put on the wrong train and shunted into our siding. So they quickly shut this door, the door of this truck, and they unloaded all the other trucks and moved. We could move them around the siding. They kept this thing and this truck in the siding, and they were helping themselves to this whiskey. Helping themselves to this whiskey, and and flogging it in the local village. There's three guys. So the three guys. So what the Americans agreed to do was to return the remainder of the whiskey, B, pay the duty on that which was missing and the cost, and deal with the three guys themselves. So that was agreed ultimately, and these three guys were whipped off the stateside within 24 hours. They went in there physically. I don't know what they served the sentence over there. But that was the story, and the police went away happy. And the unit was controlled from Germany, communication zone Germany, I guess. And the story filtered through, obviously, through the grapevine, and the general came across to do a visit from what his name was. He came across to do a visit. So what we did was we set up one of these little trains with the little trucks. We made some seats and decorated them and painted them up. And so when the general flew in with his lady and his entourage and my wife and his wife, the CEO's wife, we all boarded this little train and we went for this conducted tour around the tunnel, you see, and that's to explain it anyway. But and he said to me, then he went back to, and they had lunch in the mess, and he said, tell me the story of this whiskey. So there I was sitting in this little truck telling the general the story about it. And you see, he just laughed. I mean, there wasn't anything one could do about it. But he went away quite happy with the unit and so on and so forth. So it didn't, nobody, apart from the men involved, there was no aggravation. But eventually it wound down and there wasn't much happening. Well, it was just storage. They were just waiting. In the meantime, the MOD was developing another depot down at Caerwent in South Wales, near Newport, is that new? Yeah, an ex-naval. And there was a constant to-ing and fro-ing, myself and their technicians down there. There was another RAF liaison guy down there, my colleague who was working on. But they had to work out all the. There was about 100 odd sheds there, but they had to go. Had to make them serviceable and calculate what could go into them, but they changed the rules. Then my colleague, by that time I was finished. So that was going on in the background. It's quite a liaison. It was quite interesting. One of the points was there was a Murray Quarter. There were seven RAF Murray Quarters attached to Fold, and the captain, Weber, got the CO's house because he was technically the CO, and I got the next one to him. And then the others were filled up by devious civilians and and technicians. There was no officers' Murray Quarter, just everybody got in. Anyway, we didn't have a garage. We didn't have garages at the time, so the cars just sat outside. But the Americans, I was in a standard RAF type quarter, so I was no. We weren't. My wife and I and the kids were no strangers to this. Even the dog, which I had, this Labrador, it knew exactly where to go and where to sit and so on and so forth. And one of the perks for the RAF liaison officer was that he didn't have to pay any fuel bills. We had to buy our petrol, unfortunately, but the electricity, gas, and solid fuel was free as part of the deal. And one of the jobs I had to do was to certify all the local contractors' bills at the end of each month, or when they came in. And I was in this house, and a standard piece with a standard ideal boiler operated on coal and coke, you know. And but so every month I used to say to the captain, I said, your electricity bill is twice as much as mine, you know. And I said, my house is almost the same size as yours. Oh, go. Oh, he said, I went into the house, and one of the things was that all the windows were shut, and all the heaters were on, such as they were. All the ovens were on in the kitchen, and the temperature was way high up. I mean, I could feel it was hot. In my case, I had an ideal boiler, which I used to heat the kitchen and the hot water system and so on. Anyway, I said to myself, all the hot plates, and I didn't use the boiler. So I said, you know, you really should use the boiler. I said, it'll cut your bills down. I said, the place will be just as hot. So I had to... It was a big type four. It was a big kitchen where we could sit around in the kitchen. And my wife used to got pally with these American wives, and they used to organise little outings like to Stafford and to, crockery factories, you know, things like that, trips into Derby. But they used to congregate with my wife at 4 o'clock because you make some tea and scones. It's ridiculous, really. But she used to make tea, and he used to love to come and sit in the afternoon around the square kitchen table. It was probably about four or five of them, and have these scones, because they didn't, for some reason, have them in America. And the other thing the ladies couldn't do, they couldn't knit. So my wife used to spend time having tea and knitting and taking them out of troops. It got a bit frustrating after a while because they never used to pay, and it became expensive. But we sorted that in the end. But so cut a long story short, when the colonel said to me one day, he said, the colonel at Burtonwood said, I've been noticing your... accommodation charges, your coal, and there was are about half what my guys are. I said, yeah. I said, they haven't been able to master the boiler system. Oh, he said, what's the trouble? I said, well, they're a bit temperamental. I said, you've got to have a practice on these to get, otherwise they go out on you, you know. Oh, he said, right. Next thing, a directive comes down from Burtonwood telling all these GIs that they've got to use the central heating system. So I had to have a quick course teaching all these guys how to operate the... they were very cost-conscious, the Americans. They wouldn't do anything in spite of it without they cost it all out first. We couldn't work an Air Force like that. I mean, before they did any job, that had to be costed. And, you know, if a job was urgent, you didn't have any time to cost it. But anyway, they managed to soldier on do that. That happened all the way through, even to the extent of when they were moving down to this new depot down at Kerwent in South Wales, the GIs who had gone down to supervise the rectification were on temporary duty, obviously, like what we call a detachment. And because they were costing it, when they got to a given figure, they just chopped them and brought them all back. So that was a unit down in South Wales with the jobs. I suppose they did get funding eventually, but there was a lot of aggravation there because there was about 20 of them had gone down and were all of a sudden withdrawn after about 3 weeks, and things were in limbo. That was fair enough. The other highlight there was the general came as it went. He was quite amused. And we had subsequently, we had the early on in the trip, we had the equivalent of the Undersecretary for the War Department come. He was called the Undersecretary of the Army. He was, well, a government officer. He was next to Secretary of State, actually. Only this guy was coming, and just after, shortly after they got there, and we said, well, we'll lay, this, the captain said, we'll lay on lunch, etc., etc. And my wife was pally with his wife, and they said, well, what? And she said, well, we can't really, this guy is high in government. We just can't leave him to thick cups and no saucers. And so my wife went and gave a crash course to the GIs who were in there. Going to wait on the tables. So there's about 34 stars came. There was him and his entourage. But they handed meal over in what had been the dining room, which was fair enough. But by this time, we had, when I say we, my wife had briefed the GIs how to lay a table and serve a table, and we had got some decent class crockery. Anyway, this guy came and he had a nice meal. The meals were all right. And everything went off okay. And then in the afternoon, some along the line, he has to come back to my house for tea, which caused a bit of aggro. But anyway, we said, well, fair enough. So then we had in the RAF, Harry Quarters, this high-level guy, and he all sat down. He was such a nice guy. He came from Scotland, it transpired. He went to Dollar Academy up in just outside Edinburgh. So he was, but he'd been in States Summit. But him and his entourage, there must have been about seven of them, all sat round in the lounge and we had made tea and whatnot. But he went away quite happy with a good impression. So that was another episode. And finally, we had, this 4th of July celebration. Now, the Americans go for this in a big way. But this time, they had a barbecue, and they opened the camp up to the public. Must have been about a year after, and they had steaks, and I've never seen steaks like, you know, really big steaks. Obviously, come from their PX flown in on the. And my dog had a great day. She sat outside the next door neighbor's window, looking up, patiently waiting for these T-bone steaks. Anyway, but that went off all right. But it was quite interesting. The public in general seemed to appreciate the Americans more once they got there. They had a lot of animosity initially.
Was there any trouble? I mean, fights in the village.
Yeah, there was a few drunken accidents with cars. They were very severe, the Americans. If a guy got involved, they just took his license away and just banished him. Yeah, we had one guy who one of the top sergeants, got sent back home to the US of A.
But was there any trouble in the sort of pubs and clubs?
Not really. I always remember the top sergeant, that we had a new change of, the top sergeant that was posted in was a guy by the name of McIntosh. And this guy had come from Vietnam to us, and to UK, and he was a Silver Star holder, you know, twice, which is a very high decoration. But he was about 6 feet tall and about as nearly as wide, and he always smoked a cigar, which was, you know, a cigar and a half long. But he was a very pleasant chap. Coloured, of course. And when he said he barked an order, they really reacted. And I could hear him outside the bedroom window in the morning. He used to have all these GIs out there doing their doing their PT, and up 2 feet, and he had them on the ball there. He was a nice guy, but the thing was he was a very religious fellow apparently, and he used to go out quite regularly. But when he went out in the evenings, he was immaculate, and he wore a great big Stetson hat, and always a dark brown suit. Of course, being very dark and dark skinned, he really looked a bit. But when his goods and chattels arrived from the US of A, the Americans shipped them out in a container. And what's in the container? A Cadillac. And this Cadillac used to sit outside the station headquarters, and there was my minute Mini alongside it, you know, this great Cadillac. But he was a nice guy. We didn't have any severe disciplinary problems, apart from the one with the whiskey.